Yeah, thank you very much. Thank you for the introduction. Please try and interrupt me if I'm unclear or if it's hard to hear me. It's a little bit difficult for me to hear the room. Normally, I would say I'd love to be interrupted for questions. And I think if there's a way in which you can maybe say out the questions, I'd still love to do that. But otherwise, maybe it's easier to keep questions to the end, given the online format. Very sorry I wasn't able to visit you in person. I think I will have to still do that in the future. But yeah, I'm traveling a lot this fall, but very happy to still have this chance to talk a little bit about my work. So yes, indeed. So my name is Lieke van Solm. Indeed, I'm a graduate student in my fourth and final year. And my topic of today is stellar binaries, and I specifically isolated stellar binaries, and what we can learn about them from gravitational wave detections. So I don't think I really have to make this case to all of you, but I just want to emphasize again how interesting gravitational waves are, and specifically, why would you use gravitational waves if you want to learn something about massive stars? And I know probably you've seen the stellar graveyard plot a lot, but I think this outreach paper or this outreach poster from the Cargrad collaboration also really makes the point very well. So basically, every square on this poster shows one detection of a binary black hole merging into a single black hole. And as you all know, in 2015, we had the first ever gravitational wave detection. And shortly after that, the first gravitational wave catalog was created of just three systems. But in O2, in the second catalog, we've already more than doubled that sample. Then in O3A, we more than doubled that sample. And in O3B, we almost doubled that sample again. I'm sorry, are there technical issues or is it okay? Sorry?
No, it's yeah, it's fine. There's no problems.
Okay, that's good. No, yeah, please do interrupt me with anything's going on. Yes, so basically, since November last year, we're left here with about 100 detections of both binary black holes, binary neutron stars, and black hole neutron star mergers. And from a stellar perspective, this is an incredible database of the graveyard of massive stars, especially if you keep in mind that before gravitational waves, we only had a handful of detections of stellar mass black holes through X-ray observations. So really, this is just an enormous amount of data already that we've obtained. But this is only just the beginning. Because if you were to plot out the size of the catalog, the gravitational wave source catalog, against the year that we live in, then we are right about on track-ish after the end of O3 with an order of about 100 detections. But next year, O4 is scheduled to start to observe at design sensitivity and will at least triple or maybe even more. The number of samples that we will have. And moreover, in the following decade, we're expected to move up, when we move up to third generation detectors, we're expected to have 10 to the 5 to, so 10,000s to millions of merger events of binary black holes, black hole neutrons, and black hole neutron stars. So that's just an incredible amount of data. But not only will we have a lot of data, we will also see everything out to very high redshifts. So it won't just be a large set, it will be a pretty complete set. So this is very nicely shown by this plot where the horizon redshift out of which we can detect certain black holes of a typical mass is plotted. And this blue line is showing the advanced LIGO observations, which shows that already we can observe certain black holes of certain masses out to redshift 2, which is already pretty incredible because redshift 2 is about 10 gigayears ago. But third generation detectors, like the Cosmic Explorer and the Einstein telescope, are going to see black hole mergers out to redshift 100, which is just ridiculous because that is about 60 million years since the Big Bang, whereas the first star formation is expected to happen after 100 million years after the Big Bang. So this means that if there's any binary black hole mergers happening at before the first star formation, we will be able to see this with their generation detectors. Of course, then maybe they won't be from stellar binaries, but they could be of primordial origin. So I think this just the amount of information and the exciting things that we can do with gravitational waves can hardly be exaggerated. But of course, oh, and especially the regime, like I said, that I'm interested in is this regime for stellar mass black holes, which is nicely where the peaks of most of these distributions are. But even today, the binary black hole mergers that we observe are already possibly coming, or most likely coming, from the very early universe. And that is because the in-spiral time of merging binary black holes depends very strongly on the final configuration that you get. So it depends to first order mostly about on this final separation of two black holes that you have, but it also depends on the masses and the eccentricity. And this final configuration, if you think that these black holes might be formed by massive stars, depends very strongly on the stellar evolution that precedes these black hole mergers. So even though if a black star forms very early, massive stars only live for a couple million years, so they die almost instantaneously afterwards, the in-spiral time of the black hole merger can last anywhere between a couple million years to many giga years, and until we observe them here today. But again, emphasizing that next generation detectors are going to see the complete universe, and they reach much further. So the big question really is, what can we learn from all these merging double complex objects? And specifically, if and how can we use them to learn something about their massive stellar ancestors? These are the main questions that at least keep me up, at least during the day, because they are the topic of my PhD thesis and the general topic of my work. So how do we go about answering such questions? Well, in general, we don't do anything very unique or surprising, because basically, to interpret observations, we make predictions using models. And typically, these models consist of very large populations of binary stars. These binary models are known as binary population synthesis. However, this is where it becomes very difficult, because the evolution of massive stars depends on many, many different physical processes that that span a very large range of timescales. And a lot of these physical processes are very poorly understood or not completely incorporated in these models. And of course, we would like to model our universe from the molecules up to the biggest cosmic scales and have just one self-consistent model that that predicts everything. However, given that we have a finite computing time and finite human lifetimes, this is at the moment impossible. And we have to be one step smarter. So in order to make the right predictions, we really should ask ourselves, what is the dominant physical processes that are behind these properties of the observed properties of merging binary black holes? And so this is a little bit difficult, but it's possible. So let's have a look at observations. What are currently the observed properties of merging binary black holes? Well, as you might or might not know, black holes are luckily kind of simple objects. They basically have a mass and a spin. And in some cases, a charge, but we don't think that happens very often in nature. But of course, we're not just talking about a single black hole. We're talking about a binary black hole. So that means that we also have to deal with properties like the mass ratio between the systems, the spin orientation, so their orientation with respect to the binary orbit and tilts with respect to that, angular momentum, and the eccentricity of the orbit. Now with LIGO and Virgo, we are LIGO, Virgo, Kagra. We're really seeing the last moments of the in-spiral of a binary black hole. So this means that we typically assume or think that most of the systems will be somewhat tidally circularized. And so we don't expect much eccentricity except for the most dynamical capture models. But I would say that the current systems that we have, the current observational techniques that we have, are not the best to constrain the eccentricity distribution. Now then, the other distributions that we have left are the spins and the mass ratio. The spins of black holes leave a somewhat not a very strong imprint on the gravitational wave signal. Moreover, there is a well-known degeneracy between the chi effective, so the effective spin between the two black holes, and the mass ratio. And this makes it very complicated to measure properly the spin and the mass ratio of mass ratio distribution of the observed binary black hole mergers, at least for the moment. If you manage to measure something called higher order multiples, then you can constrain that maybe there is some mass ratio in these systems, and then you can constrain the spin. So in some cases, you will be able to do this, but currently, again, constraining the populations or the distributions of the populations for the spin and the mass ratio is difficult for this reason. And this is why there's a long and a lot of debate going on in current literature about how much black holes are spinning. Are they non-spinning or are they very spinning, or is there a small population that is maybe misaligned spinning? It's under debate, I would say, and this is why I'm putting a question mark here. So all these reasons combined are basically a reason for me to focus on the mass distribution, because this is where we currently have the strongest constraints on the properties of merging black holes. And so this gives us most hope to learn something about these those stellar ancestors and about the physics that is underlying in these distributions. Now, this is a very chaotic plot of the primary mass black hole distribution. So that's the distribution of the more massive components in a binary black hole. All these different colored lines, and this is basically just the rate distribution, all these different colored lines show different models for the black hole population. So they show different posteriors that try to fit what the binary black hole distribution, mass distribution looks like. Some of these models are very constrained. For example, the power law plus peak is what they most often use. It's a fiducial model, which just assumes, what if the mass distribution is some power law plus some peak, and then the free parameters are the location of the peak, and etc. Whereas solar models are spline models, which are a lot more free, and basically they just allow to fit any shape without making any assumptions about the underlying model. This plot shows that there's still currently a lot of debate, even for the most constrained mass distribution. But what is also shown, and what most people agree on, is that there seems to be evidence for at least two features in the mass distribution. One feature at the high mass end at about 35 solar masses, and one feature at about 10 solar masses. So to clear up this picture a little bit, I'm just going to stick with the fiducial model from the LIGO-Virgo collaboration, namely the power law plus peak model, just to have not all my plots be overly cluttered. So typically, basically the main message here is that there are features in the mass distribution. It really is clear that we cannot fit the this mass distribution of black holes with just a single power law. Now, typically, when you hear population people or stellar physicists or actually a lot of people who think about the populations of black holes, when you hear them talk about features in the mass distribution, they often are referring to this high mass feature, which was the first feature that was detected. And it was one of the most surprising things that people saw. The surprising thing there was, at least from the stellar community, was the detection of high mass black holes of more than about 40 solar masses. Now, this surprise came from something that is called parent stability supernova. Basically, from single stellar theory, there's a very robust theory that predicts that if your star is of a certain mass, it will have a certain temperature, and that temperature allows for spontaneous pair production in the core, which will lead to photons that are very used to support against collapse are suddenly being used to produce electron-positron pairs. That means you get a sudden collapse of the core in a premature stage, igniting oxygen and leading to an explosion that just blows the whole star apart without leaving any remnant whatsoever. And so stellar physicists thought that you could not form any black holes above about 45 solar masses from stars, at least not between 45 and 140 solar masses, because then some other physics kicks in that leads to direct collapse. You can form black holes again. But as I said, this is a very solid prediction that doesn't actually depend on metallicity uncertainties or winds or other things that we normally have to worry about. But it does depend on one specific rate in the core, namely the carbon to oxygen rate. And that was found by Rob Farmer in 2019, and he published a paper about it. Showing here the maximum black hole mass that you're allowed to form from a certain core or from a certain rate, given a certain carbon oxygen core rate, where if you have more oxygen, you will be more explosive and you form lower mass black holes. Whereas if you have less oxygen and more carbon, you'll be a little bit more stable against this explosion and you can form higher mass black holes from stars. And so you expect that there will be a feature or a pileup just below this parent stability limit, because if your mass is just below this parent stability limit, you will still get an explosive ignition, but it might just not be strong enough to dissolve the whole core, but it will just blow off some layers, leaving you with a slightly less massive core. So from this theory, we expected a bump. And so people saw, oh, there is a bump at 45 or about 35 solar masses. We expect there to be a drop off at 45 solar masses. Maybe this bump is coming from this parent stability supernova. But big question mark here is that since then, people investigated these rates in a lot more detail, and they found that actually, the rate should be slightly different, and the models weren't completely resolved. And so a recent paper by Farag and another paper by Mehta et al. Showed that the real location of this gap should be more at.
Is it just us or?
Maybe I should say something. Nils is online and he was saying that the mic is picking up once and again. It's very annoying when he's online. So is the battery on or off?
Off.
I mean, that's why I talk. I don't know. Because I'm not going to do about it.
Wait, it's away from me, but it's off. Maybe some. Oh. Because you're muted, right?
Yeah.
Do you want to ping her? Like,
well, maybe you don't have enough money.
Send her an email.
Oh, yeah. That's far more like half a million.
I'm so sorry. My computer just suddenly dropped out. Can you hear me again?
Yeah. It's good now.
I'm so sorry. I don't know what happened. I hope I'm going to. If you make me host again, I will share my screen again.
Yeah. Not that I'm not host. should
we talk to Yeah.
Just wait for 30 seconds.
Yeah, okay, no problem. Zoom, this is what you get for doing online talks. Trouble. Always trouble. Okay, working?
Yeah, actually, let me just check with you. Oh, okay.
I'm co-host. Yes, it worked. Okay, let me immediately try to share my screen. Yes. Okay, you should be able to see my screen.
Yeah.
I think. Okay, so sorry about that. I hope you don't see my Zoom controls. If not, I'm just going to continue. Okay. Sorry. So the gap moved up by a few masses, and I'm going to skip a few slides here because, in the interest of the 5 minutes we just lost, I want to say, okay, so we found some critical physics that was behind this bump, but at the moment it seems like this is back to a question mark, because where we initially thought this feature should happen just below 45 solar masses, we now expect this feature to happen just below 65 solar masses or 60 solar masses. So that's very far from where we actually observed the feature. So we're back to question mark there, but that just means it's very interesting, because there I have several theories of why this what this bump could be, but I don't want to focus on that today. What I do want to focus on today is the elephants in the room that most people don't really discuss, which is the most massive or the biggest peak in the distribution, that is the peak at 9 solar masses. And this feature is interesting for two reasons. Especially the low mass end is interesting for two reasons, and I think it hasn't received the amount of attention that it should. And that's for two reasons. The first reason is that many different channels have been proposed to lead to merging binary black holes, ranging from dynamical formation in clusters to bringing them together in AGN disks, to isolated binary evolution that I think about most, where mass transfer brings these two systems close together, because all of these channels are basically trying to answer the question, how do you bring two black holes so close together that they will merge in the age of within the age of a universe? Now, this makes it very difficult to constrain any of the physics that precedes these systems, because we often don't know which systems come from what channel. But at the low mass end, only very few channels are relevant. And specifically, mostly the isolated binary channels are the most likely systems, because they are the ones that predict a peak or the global peak to happen at these low masses. While the most dynamical channels, really expect the peak to happen at high masses, at 20 to 30 solar masses. But there's a second reason why the low mass end is very interesting. And that is because the low mass end is least affected by uncertainties in what we call the metallicity dependent cosmic star formation history. Now that's a mouthful, but what I mean with this metallicity dependent cosmic star formation history, which I'm not going to repeat because it's way too much, so I'm just going to say this, put this SZZ for metallicity and redshift. What I mean is just simply saying that if you look at the distribution of metallicities over the age of the universe, there is some distribution with which stars form. And we expect that in the early universe, stars form with very low metallicities. But as we move to closer to today, today probably most stars are formed with high metallicities. But the exact shape of this distribution of star formation history is unknown. Sorry, is there a question?
Oh, sorry. No, I didn't have a question.
Okay, good. No, okay. So this is really important, because this star formation history heavily affects the binary black hole merger rate that we get. And that is because binary black hole formation depends very strongly on metallicity, mainly due to the metallicity dependence of stellar winds, which affect the masses and the separations, and it's very difficult. But secondly, this function of the metallicity-dependent cosmic star formation history is very poorly constrained, especially at the low metallicities and high redshift that are most relevant for the formation of these black holes. And so there's many different ways in which we can approach this cosmic star formation history, this metallicity-dependent cosmic star formation history. And all of them are obviously valid. But what we did in some recent work was to just try and take a very simple analytical fit to this, this cosmic function that consists of a overall cosmic star formation rate part, which just tells you how many stars formed at what redshift, and a metallicity, cosmic metallicity density part, which tells you how with what metallicity did stars form at different redshifts. And the benefit of using such an analytical function is that it's very flexible. So you can just fit it with whatever new data you got, and you can fit it to match both observational constraints, but you can also fit it to match, for example, cosmological simulations. Especially in the age of JWST that we're living in right now, this is really exciting because as new information comes in, we'll be able to easily adapt it. Secondly, this analytical function has some intuitive parameters that tell something about the shape of the star formation history. And so it allows for a very systematic variation of the model parameters. And so this allows you to learn something about the effect of this cosmic star formation history on the predicted mass distribution or predicted population of black holes that you expect. And so we did exactly the latter, where basically we took a fiducial binary population synthesis model with a lot of assumptions about how binaries evolve. And then we fit our analytical model of star formation to the cosmic star formation that is in the TNG 100 simulation. And if you use this fiducial population with the TNG 100 star formation history, you get this dark blue line for the predicted population or mass distribution of merging black holes. And in the gray, I still show the power Laplace peak model, so the gravitational wave observations. But now what we can do is we can vary one aspect of this cosmic star formation. For example, here we vary the width of the metallicity distribution that we assume at redshift zero. So that's a very intuitive way of knowing what we're doing because we just vary this one parameter of the star formation shape. You can do the same game for all the different parameters that make up this cosmic star formation history. And that's what we did in exactly in this work. And we were able to draw two important conclusions from this. The first conclusion is what I started off with, which is saying that the low mass end of the mass distribution is least affected by these uncertainties in the cosmic star formation history. I'm going to flip through my variations. And I've annotated the ratio between the highest rates and the lowest rates at some different masses in the mass distribution. And I'm going to go back and forth a little bit. You will see that the low mass end is always less affected than the high mass end. And the reason for this is was actually not super surprising because it has to do again with these winds. So this is a mass distribution from a different work, from a different paper. So that's why the shape is very different, but it's showing the different contribution of different metallicities to the mass distribution of merging black holes. And blue are the lowest metallicities, while red are the highest metallicities. And it shows that for the highest mass black holes, you really need the lowest metallicity star formation. But to form lower mass black holes, where we were interested in, you really can form these from somewhat higher metallicities. And so this allows the high metallicity star formation is much better constrained, especially in the last 10 giga years, than the lowest metallicity star formation. So because there's less uncertainty in the high metallicity star formation, there's also less uncertainty in the rate of the, or the predicted rate of the low mass black holes that we get.
So can I ask something?
Yes, of course.
Yeah, so if I understood you correctly, you were saying that the reason why the low mass end doesn't change much is because the winds needed for the high mass black holes are not, those strong metal dependent winds are not so necessary for the low mass end, is that right?
Yes.
Do you also assume that the initial mass function is not strongly metallicity dependent?
That's a good question. Indeed, we are not varying the metallicity dependence of the IMF. So we're not varying the IMF with Metalicity. There is some work that has looked a little bit into this by Martina Kuschlinska, and she didn't find a strong dependence on the IMF variations. But in reality, you should take it into account. But really, the winds are the dominant factor, especially Wolverine winds are the dominant factor in placing these giant uncertainties more at the high mass end.
Sure, sure. You know, but we do see significant IMF variations for different types of galaxies, right?
Yes, yes. No, I 100% agree with that. And so in first order, I would have expected that to have a larger effect on, and I'm not saying it has zero effects, but again, the winds seem to be having a dominant effect on the masses that you can form. And that's because it's not just how many of stars you can form, which is the IMF is doing, but it's both widening and losing the mass. So if you if you have strong winds, you will lower the mass that you get and you push it to these lower mass systems, and you will widen the systems, and so you get less mergers. So it's just a matter of which effect is more dominant. But yeah, you're right. In reality, we should take into account also the metallicity dependence of the IMF.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Okay.
I have another question.
Yes, of course. Go ahead.
In many of the model predictions, it seems that there's always a broad feature from, if you could go back to, yeah, like from about 15 solar masses to all the way to 35.
Yeah.
Is there a simple reason, simple understanding of this feature?
That's a really good question, and that's specifically something I'm trying to look into now. And I have a suspicion. I think it depends on the mass transfer efficiency during the first mass transfer episode. So when you still have two stars and you transfer mass from one to the other, the efficiency of accreting mass on the secondary star at that point seems to have an effect on this bump. But I don't have a simple and intuitive answer, because I don't exactly know how this relates to each other. And so as long as I don't fully understand the feature, I also don't trust it very much, because I only trust features in my model that I know that I can physically explain. And so this is why I'm going to focus on this feature at the low mass end, because I did find an explanation for that one.
Okay.
Yeah. Stay tuned.
That feature is not there in the data, right?
No. It's definitely heavily overproduced, and there's ways in which you can get the feature to go away if you make certain assumptions about, you know, just not forming any of these high mass black holes. But I don't think that's a good thing. So indeed, we are not at a stage where we are fitting the complete data. But I think that is common against all codes. I've seen this feature also pop up in simulations by Michela Mapelli's group, who uses 7 code. And I've seen it pop up in binary C code, which is from Rob Izzard. I don't know if you notice, these are all people who work on the binary synthesis code. But there is currently no consensus as where this feature comes from and how we can get rid of it, basically. So it's work in progress.
So this is one of the main panels, right? So probably okay that it doesn't fit all the data.
Sorry, it's very hard to hear you in the room. Could you repeat the question?
It's one of the formation channels, right? So it's probably okay that it doesn't completely.
Oh, yes, exactly. Yes, this is only from isolated binary channel, and actually this is only from one sub-channel within the isolated binary evolution. So there's definitely dynamical channels also contributing. And I think it's, you know, state of the field to try and figure out how much every channel fits to everything. But we don't want to be overproducing. Then we know we're wrong for sure. So we know that this model, the dotted line here, is for sure wrong. Any other questions? Okay, then I'm going to make the second point of this work, which is that, as you might have seen, if we change the metallicity-dependent cosmic star formation history, although the different heights of the peaks change, the locations of the different features that we observe do not change. And this is really interesting because for the longest time, people thought it's very impossible to constrain anything with these models. It's so difficult. Everything is a problem. But the fact that the location of these features in a mass distribution doesn't change means that the cosmic star formation history doesn't actually affect the location of features. And so even though different features pop up and go down, the location of features in these models will tell you something about the underlying binary physics rather than the uncertainty in the cosmic star formation history. So that's really exciting because that tells us that we can maybe learn something about these about binary physics from the locations of these features. So I'm quickly going over the summary of part one because I know I'm a little bit behind in time. Basically, the binary black hole mass distribution is where we currently have the best constraints, and it shows at the moment two features. One feature at about 35 solar masses and one feature at about 9 solar masses. And I'm especially interested in this low mass feature because there's only very few formation channels that are really relevant at this lowest masses. And there's less uncertainty from the cosmic star formation rates that bothers the formation of these lowest mass black holes. So if there's no further questions, then I'm going to dig in a little bit into what this low mass feature actually entails, because I haven't really shown anything there. Sorry, is there a question?
Nope.
Okay, good. Okay, let's zoom in on the low mass end of this distribution. So basically what LIGO and Virgo have observed is that there seems to be a feature happening at about 9-ish solar masses. You might think, okay, 9 solar masses, that doesn't sound very special, you know, why not? But if it's a little bit odd if you think about the progenitors of these black holes, because the most likely progenitor of a 3 solar mass black hole is favored over the most likely progenitor of an 8 solar mass black hole by about an order of magnitude. So if you think about it, and if you just believe that this is a simple reflection of the IMF, then it's quite surprising that you don't get a lot more low mass black holes than you get 9 solar mass black holes. So I think asking the question, why is the peak of the mass distribution at 9 solar masses, is really the same as asking the question, where are the lower mass black holes, the black holes with masses between about 3 and 6-ish, 7-ish solar masses? Now, this question might sound familiar to some of you, but I'm going to be very agnostic about this and say that I think there are three reasons why we do not see merging binary black holes with a primary mass of 3 to 6 solar masses. The first reason is maybe these merging black holes exist, but we just don't see them. So maybe there's some observational bias why we don't detect merging binary black holes with low masses. Now, we actually know about the bias in our gravitational wave detectors, and we know that we're biased against these low mass black holes. In the distributions that I've been showing you so far, this is bias corrected. So there's already corrected for the observational bias, and we still expect to see some decay. But if you're really into the gravitational wave population analysis, you will also know that at the moment, it's a little bit unclear if there's really a deep dip in the mass distribution there, or if it flattens down a little bit below 10 solar masses. So at the moment, this is a little bit unclear, but the fourth gravitational wave catalog and future detectors are really going to very clearly show if this feature is the peak or if it just flattens out below. But at the moment, for the rest of this talk, I'm just going to assume for convenience that this is really real, and it is as it seems right now. It is a dip rather than a flattening. And so there's really a lack of low mass black holes. But again, future detectors will tell us the answer very soon. So that leaves us with two possible explanations for a lack of low mass black holes. The first one is maybe these black holes just don't exist. Maybe nature just doesn't like to form low mass black holes at all. And this is what you might have heard about as the neutron star black hole mass gap. Basically, this is a consequence of the fact that supernova are difficult. It's really difficult to model supernova, and we don't exactly know how to go from a CO core mass, carbon oxygen core mass, to a final remnant mass of a black hole or a neutron star. And traditionally, there's kind of two camps that say either this remnant mass distribution is smooth and there's no gap in this, or this remnant mass distribution is discontinuous and there is a gap between the most massive neutron star that you can form and the least massive black hole that you can form. The theory behind this discontinuous remnant mass function was, or this discontinuous mass function was actually thought about because of X-ray observations that were done about a decade ago, where there seemed to be a lack of low mass black holes also in X-ray binaries. However, since then, there's been a lot of debate. Actually, since the moment it was discussed or suggested, it's been very controversial, where there's a lot of people who are saying, no, there's no gap at all. There's just observational bias in X-ray binaries. There's no lack of low mass black holes. Or other people saying, no, there is observational evidence, or this theory doesn't work, or it does. So it's a whole debate. And specifically in the last few years, there have been a lot of claims of black holes that have been observed with masses that are in this mass gap. A lot of these are also been disproven again. So again, I think for now, all we can say here is a question mark. I personally don't believe in a neutron star black hole mass gap. But if there were to be one in for single stars, then it would obviously also affect the binary black hole mass distribution. But there's a third option, and this is, what if these black holes can form from stars, but they just don't make it into merging binary black holes? And this is what I would call an evolutionary bias against forming low mass black holes in merging double compact objects. This is not a very weird thing to think about, especially for gravitational wave sources, because gravitational wave sources are a really, really small subset of all the stars that are out there. Most binary stars don't make it into a merging black hole, and most stars in general won't make it into a merging or a black hole at all. And so to investigate this last option, I wanted to look into the most common, we have to look into the most common channels that are happening at the low mass end. And as I told you before, basically isolated binary evolution is most dominant, or is the most likely candidate to be dominant at the low mass end. Now, isolated binary evolution also isn't a simple thing, and it actually depends, it has multiple different subchannels that happen within this channel. But broadly, you can subdivide isolated binary evolution between things that have evolved through a common envelope at some point, or unstable mass transfer that leads to what we call a common envelope, and systems that have never experienced unstable mass transfer. And so they never experience a common envelope, and they will just go through stable mass transfer. Now, the outcomes of these two subchannels will give you different masses and different final separations, and so you expect different mass distributions from them. And for the longest time, for the last couple of years, the common envelope channel has been the dominant source, and it's even been dubbed the classical evolutionary channel in isolated binaries towards merging black holes. But more recently, in the past couple of years, people have been putting more and more arguments forward why we are probably overestimating the efficiency of common envelopes. And actually, a lot of things that go into common envelope would just lead to stellar mergers, and they will never make it to a binary black hole. And so that's why I want to focus on the stable Virchow overflow channel. But there's a second reason why I want to focus on this channel, and that is the real reason why I was looking into this. And that is shown, it's this figure. In gray, I again show the distribution of observed gravitational waves. And in pink, I show my fiducial model that I didn't tailor or anything, just plotted right when the third catalog came out, just to see what does it look like compared to the mass distribution. And you see that it fits very surprisingly well. It actually seems to reproduce the same drop towards lower mass black holes, and it seems to match the rates at the peak of the mass distribution. But my motto is, you should never trust your simulations unless you understand why, because there's lots of uncertainties in these models. So unless you really know what the dominant underlying physics is that causes this behavior, you can't trust any of it. So I set out to go and try and explain why the stable mass transfer channel displays this drop at the right location. Why is there a drop towards lower mass black holes? And it turned out that the key physics here is requiring the mass transfer to be stable. Especially this cartoon shows the evolution of a binary star to a binary black hole, or black hole neutron star. And the stable channel is relatively simple, whereas you can break it down in just a few parameters that determine the mass of the core, the mass transfer efficiency, et cetera. And you will see that these stars have to go through at least two phases of mass transfer. And for it to be the stable channel, both of these mass transfer phases have to be stable, which is in the name, obviously. Now, stability of mass transfer depends mostly on the mass ratio of the stars that are involved. And so the stability of the second mass transfer, which is apparently, which turned out to be the dominant one, depends on the mass of the star, and the mass of the black hole at that point. And this inequality right here turns out that we could turn this inequality into an inequality about the minimum black hole mass, primary black hole mass, that you can form from this channel. More specifically, we found that I can analytically express the minimum black hole mass that you expect from this channel based only on the ZAMS mass ratio, so the zero H main sequence mass ratio, and four basic physics parameters, or kind of uncertain physics parameters, that determine the evolution in this channel. So that was really exciting. We found an analytical function, but of course you then want to see, does this fit, analytical function fits what we see in our simulations? And so,
Can I ask something about the previous slide?
Yeah, of course.
So what happens when the mass ratio is bigger than your Q critical?
I'm speeding up a little bit because of the time, but then basically you get the other channel. So basically you get unstable mass transfer, and it leads to a common envelope. And so I didn't kick these systems out. I did evolve them through, but for the purpose of this work, I wasn't looking at them. And I was just assuming, okay, given all this work, maybe things that lead to a common envelope will lead to a stellar merger rather than a binary black hole.
Okay, got it. Thanks.
Yeah, no, of course. Okay, so we found analytical function. And then what I'm plotting here is the more massive black hole components as a function of the ZAMS mass ratio. And in the gray dots, I'm just plotting a vanilla population synthesis model, where the only requirement on this population that I'm setting is I want systems that undergo two phases of stable mass transfer. And that's all. That's all the requirements that I ask. And you already see that there seems to be a kind of a relationship between a mass ratio and a minimum black hole mass that you can form. And then this is our analytical prediction for the location of that minimum. So he's very excited to see that, yes, it actually seems to predict or explain the behavior that we see in our simulations. And to quantify this, so this is not a fit, this is really just the analytical formula. To quantify this, I'm drawing triangles over where the 99th percentile of the simulated population is. So where 99% of the simulation has a mass higher or equal to that mass. So now we know that this works for one variation. We can check different variations of the mass distribution as well. And so that's exactly what we did. Given those different physics parameters, those uncertain physics parameters, we were able to vary both our simulations and our analytical prediction. And the result is shown in this plot here. So this variation shows different physics variations, assuming different core sizes, different fractions of the core for stars, where the triangles again match the simulations and the lines, dashed and solid lines, are analytical prediction. And you see that even for different variations, our prediction holds pretty well. I mean, it's not perfect, but it's a pretty exciting match to what we see in the observations, given how little constraints we put into the analytical function. But of course, we want to move from just an initial distribution in the M's mass ratios to the full-fledged mass distribution so we can compare it to observations as well. So what I did was take these simulated populations and then compute their mass rates, their binary black hole merger rates, etc., to produce the mass distributions, which is the plots that you see at the right here. And you see that the higher cutoff mass, so if the mass, the minimum black hole mass that you're allowed to get has a very high value, like this dark line here, then you also move the distribution to higher minimum black hole masses. And so you basically open up this gap between the most massive neutron star and the least massive black hole that you would see in gravitational waves. And in this specific case, it also determines the height of the peak, or it changes the height of the peak. So both the location and the height of the peak are influenced or determined by this physical uncertainty. Now, we did the same game for the mass transfer stability, which was one of the variations that we found very relevant. And we found a similar relation where the analytical formula really well can very nicely predict and explain the simulations that we get. And lastly, we did the same as well for the amount of mass that was accreted during the first mass transfer. And so in the interest of time, I'm just going to go to the conclusions from at least from part two. So this shows that the stable mass transfer channel leads to a cutoff in the primary black hole mass that you are expected to be able to get. And so it predicts that there is a lack of low mass black holes in the observed binary black hole distribution that could look like a neutron star black hole mass gap, even though there is no remnant supernova remnant mass function involved, or at least no gap in the remnant mass function. And secondly, this cutoff determines the location or explains the behavior of the location of the peak that you expect from this channel. So the summary here is that the low mass peak in the black hole mass distribution is really interesting. And it can either be telling us something about the supernova remnant mass function or the binary physics that dominates at this location. And we found that the stable mass transfer channel can naturally explain the location of this peak, which means two important things. It has two important implications. Firstly, there's no need for a gap in a remnant mass distribution, at least not to explain gravitational wave observations. Secondly, there's no need for the classical common envelope channel. And this is really exciting because it's almost a paradigm shift, moving from we need 100% need common envelopes to explain the binary black hole population to maybe the stable channel is dominant for the black hole population. I do want to warn you that common envelopes are very much needed to produce binary neutron stars, because given that there's this cutoff in the stable mass transfer channel, it also shows that this channel is really bad at producing the lowest mass systems like binary neutron stars. And so common envelopes are 100% needed for binary neutron stars and binary white dwarfs, but maybe not at all relevant for binary black holes. We don't know, but we can't say they're not per se needed. So I want to end with a little bit of an outlook that, again, and emphasize that the next generation or the next releases of gravitational waves are going to give us a lot of answers because they resolve these features. Moreover, detections in the electromagnetic spectrum from Gaia and microlensing will give us independent measurements of black hole masses that can tell us something about the mass distribution of systems that are not in gravitational waves. And so if we see a gap in a random mass distribution there, then we can maybe say, okay, maybe there's still something to say for this supernova remnant mass function or gap in the supernova remnant masses. But if we don't see that, and we keep seeing it in gravitational waves, then that's the smoking gun for the stable mass transfer channel being dominant at the low mass end. I think I just want to end here and say that the future, in any case, with all the data that is coming, is very, very bright. And it is especially bright in gravitational waves. So thank you very much for sticking with me through this a little complicated online talk. And I take any questions from whoever is still available.
So that's any questions from online?
Yeah, I got a question. Yeah, so your stable mass transfer model, do you also make a prediction, for like the mass ratios of these melting black holes?
Yes. Okay. I'm going to, let me see if I can end my show for a little bit so I can, are you still seeing my screen or not?
No, we see you now.
Okay. Let me just share again. Okay. Now you're seeing my presentation, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Just doing this so I can scroll through and you don't have to sit through all of my extra slides. So basically we also computed the mass ratio distribution, but in the distributions that I showed you so far, I plotted both the binary black hole and black hole neutron star distribution, because I was very focused on seeing if there's this gap at the low mass end. And you can't really say anything about a gap between neutron stars and black holes without including the black hole neutron stars. And so, unfortunately, I forgot to put in the mass ratio distributions for only the black holes, but I do have them here for all variations with black hole neutron stars and binary black holes. And that's this plot here on the right. So you will see two bumps. And the bump at the low end is from black hole neutron star mergers, but this bump at the higher mass end is from the binary black hole mergers. And so if you just imagine this one away, then it goes kind of straight down from here. So there's two things. We kind of robustly or consistently expect the peak of the black hole mass ratio distribution to be somewhere between 0.6 and 0.9, which is a little bit lower than the peak of the mass distribution of binary black holes as observed. But I want to make a strong connotation there that the way that people in the observations are fitting the mass ratio distribution is just with a single power law. There hasn't been much exploration for different shapes in the observations. So I'm not very worried that we don't exactly match it at the moment, because we're also not terribly inconsistent.
Okay, got it. Thank you.
Yes.
I have a couple of questions. One is that, so my understanding is that you have like three parameters which you can adjust to, you know, determine the location of the peak. Uh-huh. Are there independent observational measurement for those parameters, such as the core mass fraction, and then you have this beta parameter for the efficiency of the the degree of being conservative for the first mass transfer. So are there observational constraints on those parameters?
Yeah, that's a really, really good question. That's actually something that I really want to and try to look into more. So it's very difficult because most observations that we have of stars that are alive are of low mass stars. And low mass stars don't per se behave the same as high mass stars. This is one of the reasons why gravitational waves are so exciting, because it kind of gives us this peek into the lives and deaths of massive stars that we normally don't have, because massive stars are really rare and they die really quickly. So specifically for mass transfer efficiency, there are some observations, but they're mostly of white dwarfs and other systems where we can measure the masses and the mass transfer or the ages. So we have a lot of the parameters constrained. And so there is a little bit of constraints on what the mass transfer efficiency must have been. But the observations, these are really single observations of one system there, one system there, and they vary between like 0 to 0.9. And then again, this is on low masses. So it's really difficult is the main constraint. So some of these other things we can constrain a little bit. Sorry,
go ahead.
So for example, for the core masses, the main sequence, the width of the main sequence has some information on what core masses we have, and we think we should move up rather than down. So there's some constraints there. And the mass transfer stability, really there's a couple of ways that we can go, but it's also very difficult. But what we really need to do is take constraints from electromagnetic observations of things like luminous red novae, which are supposedly stellar mergers, and see if we can tailor that with the stability that we get here. So it's a very, very, very complex problem. And there are some hints, but it's not like we can just pin one of these down, which is why there are also these massive uncertainties in our models.
I see. Another question I have is, how long does the stable mass transfer phase last for? And are we seeing systems like that, like ongoing, stable mass transfer ongoing?
Yeah. Very good question as well. Basically, this stable mass transfer lasts about the thermal time scale of the donor. So that's not very long. The whole lifetime of these stars, again, is only like 5 million years. So this whole from start to finish, couple million years, maybe 20 or 30 at most, but not much more. So thermal time scale here is really short. We have a couple of high mass X-ray binaries, but they're mostly kind of right before Virchow overflowing. So those are stars that are, you know, at the border here, and they have masses that already overflow the masses, but it's very difficult to capture this exact moment. What we will be able to capture more, hopefully, with X-ray observations and surfaces, so that this phase right before, which lasts a little bit longer, and maybe the effects of the mass transfer here, where we can see some circumbinary ring or outflows or stuff that maybe could be related to this.
Thank you.
So in those X-ray binaries, we don't see, we observe a mass gap for the black hole, we don't see like black hole mass below 5. So is it consistent with what you said here, or why we don't?
Yeah.
See?
So by high mass X-ray binaries, in X-ray binaries, we still only have a few systems. I mean, order of, I think all X-ray binaries are still order of tens, not many more. So it's not that many, especially in high mass X-ray binaries, it's even less, and it's very difficult and sparse. So the original mass gap was indeed proposed based on these high mass X-ray observations. And so that was very difficult statistics, and this is why it has gotten so much critique, or there's so much discussion about it. It's not per se critique, it's just discussion. Is, are we just biased against observing only those that that have somewhat higher masses in the local universe or not? And there's one big complication here to keep in mind, because while we really want to link X-ray binaries as progenitors of gravitational waves, seeing as that this phase, these two phases, would indeed be X-ray binaries, we're not sure that the X-ray binaries we see today are in any way similar to the X-ray binaries that precede gravitational waves. And that has to do again with this picture here, where the gravitational waves that we observe today can come from binaries that lived very, very long ago at way different metallicities. Whereas the X-ray binaries that we observe today must be coming from the very nearby and recent universe, because we don't see the X-ray so far, and so they are basically all in our galaxy at very high metallicities. And so there's a lot of work by, for example, Maya Fischbach and other people on thinking about the overlap between the X-ray binary population that we see and the gravitational wave population.
Right. I mean, yes, they could come from different channels. Maybe the X-ray binaries will never merge. But I guess what you are suggesting is that maybe there is no mass gap in terms of forming those low mass black holes. Maybe there are low mass black holes, right? Like it's just an evolution bias.
Exactly. So
what I'm asking is for these X-ray binaries, I mean, is there also evolution bias, or do you expect there is
So if the same evolutionary bias holds for X-ray binaries, that's what you're asking, right? So not per se, because as I was saying, so the X-ray binaries that we see, the high mass X-ray binaries, are right before the second mass transfer phase. And as I was saying here, the second mass transfer phase is key into making this evolutionary bias. And so basically, you observe high mass X-ray binaries right before the cut. So if these high mass X-ray binaries would go into unstable mass transfer, then it would maybe form a common envelope. They would maybe merge as stars, and you wouldn't see them as gravitational waves. But the X-ray phase is just before where the cutoff from this evolutionary phase comes, over this evolutionary bias. So I think one way to kind of prove that the gravitational wave population is biased would be to see lower mass black holes in X-ray binaries. Again, at the moment, we only have like 5 high mass X-ray binaries. But if we see them with lower masses, and we don't see them in gravitational waves with lower masses, then that shows that this second mass transfer phase might be relevant for the gravitational wave population. Does that make sense? Does that answer your question?
Yep. Yes.
I don't know if you can hear me.
Yes, I think I can.
So besides X-ray binaries, are there other electromagnetic observations that will help constraining your model for this first peak?
So I think, again, on the kind of counter, as a very good question, first of all, the counter argument of the common envelopes. If we can constrain the rates of common envelopes, then it helps us in some way constrain the rate of unstable mass transfer and what we kind of see at the other side of the population. And so common envelopes, we have some hope in observing their remnants in luminous red novae. And especially with LSST, we will be spanning a lot of luminous red novae, or we expect to see a lot of those. And that can help us constrain the rate of these systems happening, and thereby also constrain the rate of these things not happening. So basically saying, oh, this is the other part of the same. distribution. So other things, as I mentioned before a little bit, would be the core mass fraction. If we are able to kind of determine how much overshooting and how big these cores are. And this is where, at least at the lower masses, astroseismology and a lot of work is being done. And it seems to be moving towards somewhat slightly bigger cores. So I think there we can hopefully extrapolate some of the observations that we have from the somewhat lower masses to the somewhat higher masses. The accretion efficiency stays is still very difficult. I would hope to meet someone who says, I have the perfect observations for you to constrain this. But at the moment, I think it's very difficult, even at low masses. And we don't have much constraints properly for the high masses. We just have a lot of theory, but no observations.
Thank you. I have one more quick question. So in the first part, you mentioned that you used TNG simulations.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So I don't know anything about this, but how do you include that in your model?
Yeah. So basically, it's very simple. We only take the rates. So we take at every snapshot, we took the rates of the star forming, the gas particles, the star forming rate of them and their metallicity. And that basically gives you a 2D distribution in this plot and the background. And that just tells you, that just gives you a distribution of saying, okay, in TNG at redshift 3, this much star formation is happening at solar metallicity, and this much star formation is happening at 1/100th of solar. So it's just how do you say that? It's just a rate that we take. And then we weigh our system. So how it works, maybe that is what I didn't explain clearly. So how this works is when we run our binary population model, we basically run binaries in isolation. So we sample a bunch of binary stars from initial mass distributions and period distribution and mass ratio distributions. And we evolve these through until they form merging binary black holes. And then I evolve 10 to the 7 of these, so 10 million of these binaries for every different variation. And then on top of this, I also use some adaptive importance sampling methods to kind of pick out the ones that will most likely form binary black holes. And these stars, they get a metallicity at birth. And then I link that metallicity, or the likeliness of that metallicity being born at a certain redshift, using basically this picture here from TNG. So I say, okay, I formed a binary black hole using a star that was 1/10 solar metallicity. And then I place it in cosmic, you call this cosmic integration. I place it in cosmic context by saying, okay, how many stars were formed in TNG with this metallicity? Does that make sense?
Yeah, thank you.
Any additional questions?
Oh,
okay. If not, let's thank Nick again for the great talk and discussion.